From The Conversation, this is Politics with Michelle Grattan, a podcast where we hear from politicians and experts on the issues of the day.
Backbenchers these days on both sides of politics are often so wedded to talking points that they have little voice of their own. They can seem to be less individuals on the national stage and more just troops for their leader. But some do manage to develop a presence. The Liberals' Dave Sharma is one of those, a first-termer who won the marginal Sydney seat of Wentworth from independent Kieran Phelps in 2019. The Liberals had lost the seat when Malcolm Turnbull quit Parliament. Sharma has a background in the world of diplomacy and was formerly Australia's ambassador to Israel. He joins us today to talk about life on the backbench, the role of the moderates in the Liberal Party, current issues and next year's election. Dave Sharma, is the life of a government backbencher more frustrating than it should be? Should they be given more of an active role?
Look, I don't find the life of a backbencher frustrating. I think it's very much dependent on the individual. There is actually a lot of freedom in the role, and there's a lot of entrepreneurialism, should you wish to use it that way. People have, you know, take different approaches to the role. But I think if you're creative and innovative, and you're prepared to take some risks or put your neck out on issues that you think are important, you can actually have quite a significant influence. So I think it depends on the individual, but you know, my view is that you do want backbenchers out there pushing policy, making the case publicly, floating new ideas as well. They've got a freedom that members of the executive don't, and it should be used.
Have you found if you've put your neck out that you get a phone call from the PMO or someone else?
No, not generally. I mean, I tend to know, I have a good sense of, I guess, or a good judgment, in my view at least anyway, of when what you're doing ceases to be constructive and starts to be a distraction. That's always an individual judgment, though. And, you know, I'm also of the view that I'm not part of the executive, so I am expected to do things and say things, and I'm not bound in the same way that an executive part of the executive is. So I have never had a personal experience of being disciplined or reprimanded. And I think, generally speaking, the government and this cabinet is quite respectful of the freedoms and the, you know, the contributions that backbenchers can make. I don't think it's a regime of fear at all.
Now, you're one of the Liberal moderates. In recent years, the moderates in the Liberal Party have become something of an endangered species. But recently, we have seen more of their activities and we've heard more moderate voices. For example, they made representations to Scott Morrison on climate change policy. What's happening here? Is there a new generation of moderates coming through, or are there other factors at play?
I guess I'm not a huge fan of factional labels, and I would never really label myself. I'm a Liberal first and foremost, and we've got a pretty broad spectrum of views within that. But I would say what I think has changed is, or look, at least what I've noticed in my intake, that is people who became members of Parliament or were elected in 2019. Look, most of them have had substantial careers and professional achievements beforehand. Most of them are quite accomplished and capable in their own individual fields. Most of them have got the, you know, maturity and judgment that comes with that. And I think that means that they're more likely, they're more inclined to back their own viewpoint. They're more inclined to want to make an impact and make their presence felt rather than necessarily stay for a long time. And I think they're more inclined to speak out because they're used to doing that in their professional life. And they don't see why when they come to Parliament they should be suddenly, you know, relegated to a juvenile status. I think that's what's changed. The people who I've come in with, at least, I think have, you know, a healthy degree of self-confidence and a healthy wish to put their own opinions forward. And I think that's ultimately, it's good for us as a governing party, but it's also good for the state of democracy in Australia.
The main parties in particular have trouble recruiting members these days. What sort of people do you think are joining the Liberal Party? And at the risk of using those factional labels, are they more conservative than moderate? Are they older rather than younger?
So look, I have a my perspective on this is not especially well formed because I didn't really come through the party machinery. My, you know, professional career beforehand as a diplomat and a public servant man, I didn't really get involved in party politics much or party machinery. So I've come to this as a bit of an outsider. But my sense is, I have a lot to do with the young Liberals, the younger part of the political party, and then I have a lot to do with the members in my own electorate of Wentworth. The younger members of the party, I think, reflect the outlook and the values of their generation. And, you know, generally speaking, most younger generations are more progressive than their older generations. And certainly the younger Liberals I meet with are keen for us to take climate change seriously and act on climate change, are very big on the equality agenda, if you like, between making sure that people of different sexuality or gender orientation have the same rights as other people. And they're interested in some of the new forces that are reshaping our economy and our society, particularly, you know, digital and digital platforms and those sorts of things. I think that's who tends to be joining the party. There's, I don't really think, my view would be they're no more, they're kind of centre-right in outlook. The older part of the party membership would tend to be more conservative. And look, I think that's as much a reflection of their age and their generation as anything else. But where I am in Wentworth, at least, I would say the party membership would tend to be more towards the centre than towards the right in my part of Sydney.
Now, you've been outspoken on the need for a credible climate change policy. Do you think Australia should improve its medium-term target next year when countries have been requested to take back enhanced targets to the next climate conference?
I don't think we should rule anything out. I mean, I'm conscious when we were elected in 2019, net zero by 2050 was not really a thing. It certainly wasn't what people in the international climate change negotiations were talking about. People were talking about 2030 targets. People were talking about the contribution that developing countries might make. People were talking about climate finance and mitigation adaptation. So, you know, a few years is a long time in these international negotiations. I don't think we should be ruling anything out. I think we need to see, you know, firstly, what the international environment is like going into that. The next COP27, which I believe is going to be in Egypt, and how we're also tracking as a nation. That said, you know, I do believe we took an election commitment for a 2030 target of 26% to 28% to the last election, and we did get a mandate for that. And I'm a strong believer in remaining faithful to, you know, one's election platform.
But there will be another election before we go back to this conference.
There will be, you know, undoubtedly that will be a discussion. I don't envisage us, I'm not obviously part of the government, I mean, I'm part of the governing party, but not part of the government. I don't envisage us, and it seems the government's ruled out a higher binding target for 2030, but they've certainly made clear that we're going to continue to update our emissions projections. I think that's important. I think too often in these negotiations, people are judged by the significance of their commitments rather than the significance of their delivery. And ultimately it's delivery that matters here for the environment and the atmosphere, not commitment. So, you know, I don't feel pressured as Australia that we need to match our target just for the sake of it. I think it's more important to deliver. But that said, I think we always need to be mindful of where the international environment is at on this. And that's very much shaped our attitude towards adopting net zero by 2050. We recognise that there was a changing constellation of forces, if you like, around this: global capital markets, our major trading partners, our major security partners. And Australia's always been a country that, you know, doesn't seek to be an outlier in the world. It seeks to move with the major currents of world opinion and world developments.
So given the situation, do you think that the coalition at the election should give itself flexibility to improve the medium-term target next year?
Well, look, like I said, I don't think we should be ruling anything out. And I don't think we are. I mean, I think we've made very clear the direction of travel on this. We've made very clear that the destination and the end point is net zero by 2050. And obviously to get to net zero, we need to be hitting credible milestones along the way. I do accept the argument that, you know, this transition, if you like, is not going to be linear. It will. It's not going to be a straight line. It's going to be a downward sloping exponential curve, because as new technologies come on, some of this the effort of this transition will be easier. So, look, I know I'm not giving you a straight answer here. I would say that I wouldn't be ruling it out, but nor do I think we necessarily need to be ruling it in. I think we need to, you know, maintain our options and keep our options open.
Now, you're heading into the final 2 weeks of Parliament for the year, and this will include some really controversial legislation. The government will introduce its religious discrimination bill, and although this is a little less clear, it's due to bring in its long-awaited legislation for a National Integrity Commission. Also, there's the bill for the voter ID requirement, which is already in the Parliament, but the government wants it through by Christmas. So let's look at these individually. On religious discrimination, is this legislation actually necessary, and when do you think the government will want it passed?
Look, I think it's a commitment that we made, and it's certainly before my time in Parliament. I'm yet to see obvious cases of people being discriminated against on the basis of their faith. That doesn't mean I don't accept that it's theoretically possible, and I don't believe that it's harmful to enact protections narrowly drawn against being discriminated against on the basis of their faith. So I think it's a useful complement to our suite of human rights legislation, the Sexual Discrimination Act, the Racial Discrimination Act, various other pieces of human rights machinery we have in there. I guess my concern is that what should be a shield only is not allowed to become a sword, and that is that people should be protected against discrimination on the basis of their religion, but someone's religion or faith should not give them a positive right to discriminate against other people that's not enjoyed by non-religious people or other Australians. That's what I'm very keen to see in this particular piece of legislation.
Now, backbenchers have been briefed on the legislation, even though they don't have the actual bill or the wording of it. But on what you know of it, are you satisfied, or do you think more fine-tuning needs to be done?
Look, I do need to see the text of the legislation to reassure myself about it before, and I have to reserve my position until I've seen that. But I would say that from what I've seen and what I understand, significant improvements have been made. And the issues that are of greatest concern to particularly the LGBTIQ community, the big ones there have been addressed. This is the so-called Fallow Clause, conscientious objection. Those things are no longer now. There's no longer provisions in the bill that relate to that. And I think the statement by the Attorney General earlier today that we're instructing the Law Reform Commission to accelerate the development of legislation to prevent discrimination against students on the basis of their sexuality or gender orientation is another important part of that.
So have you had many representations from your electorate on this legislation?
Look, I've had ongoing dialogue with my electorate on this legislation really since I was elected to Parliament, with advocacy groups, lobby groups, but also individuals. And, you know, some of them are faith-based groups. The Jewish community is a sizable presence in my electorate, but there are also other communities of faith who in particular want to see that their right to positively discriminate in their hiring choices for people of the same faith, particularly in, you know, key positions, is maintained. And I respect and understand that as well. I think if we're going to allow faith-based institutions such as schools, we need to allow them to recruit people of the same faith to keep these communities together. I think it's getting the balance right there by allowing that sort of affirmative discrimination, if you like, without it coming at the expense of the rights of other people. That's a tricky balance to strike.
On the National Integrity Commission, the earlier model was, of course, much criticised, and we don't have the final model yet. But do you think there should be a provision for public hearings, which was not in the earlier draft?
I'd say by way of preamble that there's a whole number of different models of anti-corruption commissions or integrity commissions across all the states and territories in Australia, and they really fall across the spectrum. Some, lean more towards public hearings by default and private only by exception, whereas some are sort of private by default and public only in exceptional circumstances. I guess my view here is that the reason I don't believe there's a, you know, large-scale corruption problem at the federal government level. But that said, I accept the argument that people, that if that's the case, what harm would an integrity commission do? And it would go some way towards addressing what people cite as a public deficit of trust in these institutions. So I'm open and supportive of the idea. I'm also conscious, though, that I don't want to disrupt the balance of power, if you like, or the separation of powers in our constitutional system. And I don't want a situation where an unelected judicial body is basically putting itself in the shoes of the executive and second-guessing the executive's decisions about, you know, allocation of resources or policy decisions. That's what elected representatives are for, and they're accountable to the public. With all that said, I think public hearings will be important because, you know, justice not only needs to be done but needs to be seen to be done. And public hearings will address an important purpose of these bodies, which is to reassure the public that their government is clean, and if it's not, that it's being held accountable. I don't think you can do that with private hearings alone. I think there's certainly a role for private hearings to protect the reputations of the innocent and to make sure their procedural rights are properly protected. But there's certainly also a role for public hearings when the circumstances warrant it.
Liberals seem to have differing views over the performance of ICAC in New South Wales. What's your view?
Well, I would say that ICAC has terminated the careers of three premiers now, Nick Greiner, Barry O'Farrell and Gladys Berejiklian. For the first two of those, they were never ultimately found guilty of any corrupt conduct. For the third, Gladys Berejiklian, those hearings are ongoing. But it does trouble me the way that ICAC has been allowed to, I guess, terminate the political careers of premiers and the way it's operated to do so, when ultimately the findings have not supported that. Now, that's not ICAC's fault necessarily. They haven't said the premier must resign. But it's become a feature of the political system that the mere airing of allegations is sufficient to fatally damage a political leader. And I don't want a situation where a body like this is misused or weaponized or used vexatiously or litigiously to tar one's political opponents, because, you know, politicians will, I'm one of them, I know, but politicians will reach to whatever tools that are available to wage political warfare. And ICAC is quite a powerful tool in that toolkit. So we need to make sure that there are protections in place to make sure it can't be misused like that. I think the New South Wales model doesn't have sufficient procedural protections for people who are accused only. I think it's fallen short in that regard, and we've warned the political consequences of that.
The government is very anxious to, in this coming fortnight, get through legislation to require voters to produce ID when they turn up at the polling booth. The critics of this legislation say that this will disadvantage Indigenous people, homeless people, and a number of others, even though there are some built-in protections. Do you think they have a case?
No, I don't think so. I mean, to enrol to vote in Australia, to get on the electoral roll, you need to produce identification. That's the only way you get on the electoral roll. And so I think asking people to produce identification when they vote is not onerous, because people must already have that identification to get on the voting roll. And the other thing, we produce identification, for all sorts of transactions in Australia, to visit your GP, you'll present your Medicare card, to get into a restaurant at the moment, you'll present your COVID vaccination certificate. And there's also provision in the legislation to allow people to make a declaration vote. So if they don't have identification, they can make a declaration vote, which is allowed currently, and that vote will still be counted provided the requirements are met. So I don't see a risk of anyone being disenfranchised. Where I think people are getting this wrong is they're importing kind of an American-style argument here. But in America, voting is not compulsory, unlike in Australia. And so anything that deters turnout, which could include identification, might reduce participation. And in America, photo identification is much less prevalent than in Australia. I've lived there for several years. It's not nearly as ubiquitous as it is in Australia. So I think that's why, people who are saying this will harm turnout, I think are misguided.
Now, as you mentioned, your background is in diplomacy. So can I ask you about Australia's policy on China? Obviously, our relationship with China is at a very low point, and the government is talking very tough, especially Defence Minister Peter Dutton. But we're now seeing an apparent change in tone towards China by the United States. We saw the joint US-China climate statement at Glasgow, and this week, the long talk between the two presidents. How do you read these new American developments? And does Australia need to put more nuance into its China policy?
Well, to start with, I'm very encouraged by these developments. And I actually think they mark a change in behaviour and statecraft by the People's Republic of China. We saw them play what I would concede and respectfully concede as a constructive role at Glasgow at COP26. I thought they did. They made important concessions, and they also contributed actively to discussions and conversations. I think the recent discussions with the US administration, the Biden Xi summit, also marked a constructive tone and much less belligerent tone from China's leadership. So I think what we're seeing there is a reassessment of their own strategy and a recognition that some of their quite aggressive, nakedly aggressive tactics of the last 12 to 18 months have not served them well and have led to their isolation. And we've been collateral damage in that, we as Australia. So I'm encouraged by the developments between the US and China and the more constructive attitude that China's leadership seems to be taking to their position in the world. I think, you know, we should, as we always do, but we should pursue a warming, you know, the re-establishment of normal diplomatic relations with China. I think it's been unfortunate that they've sort of halted diplomatic contacts, at least at the ministerial level. And we should always be looking at ways to resume those, because although we're not going to agree on every issue and we have quite different interests and values, ultimately we live in the same region together. There's a remarkable degree of common interests that we share. We're well integrated trading and economic partners. It's too important a relationship not to allow or not to be striving every day to ensure that it works better.
So what can we do from this end to try and improve the relationship?
Well, I think we can continue and should continue making overtures towards China and China's leadership. Ultimately, you know, by and large, the ball is in their court, in my view. They would argue that the ball is in Australia's court, but that would be to do things that no self-respecting, sovereign, democratically elected government could or would do. And I think they know that the sort of the so-called list of demands that they made of us, you know, were like the Austrian ultimatum to Serbia at the start of World War I. They were never going to be met. But I think what I would hope to see is if we continue to indicate our willingness to engage, we should always be looking at ways to take down the temperature. I'm not a believer in having gratuitous and stand-up fights for the sake of it. When Australian interests are involved, absolutely. When Australian values are involved, absolutely. But not just for the sake of having an argument. So, you know, we should always. It's an incredibly important relationship with that we've got Australia with China. We should always work hard at it, but we can't and we shouldn't ever compromise our national interests in doing so. And I think that's where this argument, domestically at least, is sometimes. I found a little puzzling, because the people who say we own some share of responsibility for the breakdown in relations with China, if you ask what their prescription is, it's to do things that are clearly against our national interests. And I don't think any Australian politician of any political persuasion could or should agree to that.
Should we tone down the rhetoric a bit, though?
Oh, look, I'm not a fan of overblown rhetoric at any time. Being a diplomat, that wouldn't surprise you. I don't think that toning down suggests that it's been turned up too much. I don't think that's the case. I mean, if you look at some of the things that comes out of the China's foreign ministry spokesman or their Pravda, their Global Times, they say some astonishing things about Australia. I don't take it personally. I don't think anyone does. But to suggest that the fault in tone is Australia's alone, I think, is a gross misreading of the situation.
Now, just finally, turning to the election, 2019 seemed an impossible fight for the government, and indeed perhaps for you and Wentworth, until it won that fight and you won the fight. Is 2022 looking even harder?
Look, I don't think it's going to be easy. I think we're certainly competitive, and I think we've got a good story to sell and good policies to sell. But look, elections in Australia are close. You have to remember that we only have a one-seat majority. You know, we've losing a seat in Western Australia through a redistribution. There's a notional Labor seat being created in Victoria through a redistribution. So, you know, I think we're certainly facing a tough landscape. And look, I think every Australian election is competitive and closely fought and closely contested. So I certainly think we can win the election, but I think we've got to work quite hard to convince the public that we need another term.
Dave Sharma, thank you very much for talking with us today. And that's all for the Conversations Politics podcast. Thank you to my producer, Ellen Duffy. We'll be back with another interview soon, but goodbye for now.
Our theme music is by Lee Rosevere. You can find more podcasts from The Conversation on our website at theconversation.com.